By now, you've heard about Global Poker, one of the fastest growing online card rooms available in the US and Canada today. So what's stopping you from trying it out? Global Poker is a safe and secure social poker site that uses their own patented sweepstakes model. Signing up is easy. You can use Google, Facebook, or just an email address. You can always play for free on Global Poker, but you can also buy gold coins for additional play, which will earn sweeps coins that can be redeemed for real cash to a bank account, Skrill account, or even as a gift card. Get a free 5,000 gold coins when you sign up right now at globalpoker.com.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 115, and it features 2014 World Series of Poker main event champion, Martin Jacobson. Martin found poker as a teenager in Stockholm, but was already set down a career path towards becoming a chef, which is eventually what he did, after a year in the Royal Swedish Navy. A few satellite wins saw him take shots on the European Poker Tour, and after a $250,000 score at the 2008 EPT Budapest main event, he was off and running. He continued to do well on the European circuit and even graduated to the high rollers before his life-changing $10 million WSOP main event win. He has a total of $17 million in career tournament earnings, which is three times his nearest competitor on Sweden's all-time money list. Anyway, that's enough intro. Here is my conversation with Martin Jacobson. I am here with Martin Jacobson. How you doing, Martin?
Good, man. How are you?
Great. You know, things seem to be appearing to go back to normal here in the States as far as, you know, live poker is concerned. I know things are a lot different where you currently are in London. How has your lockdown been?
It's been all right, but at the end of it, you were kind of sick of it, obviously. But I just, I kept telling myself how fortunate I am to not be as affected as 99% of the rest of the world has been. I've been able to play online and sort of go on with my life. The only thing that I haven't been able to do, apart from the things that no one's been able to do, like seeing their friends and family and going to restaurants and all that. But work-wise, I haven't been able to travel and play live poker. But that's been the main difference, really. And something I miss. I come to realize how all these years I've just been traveling so much and like taking all this for granted, and then last year, when you didn't have the opportunity to do so, you really started to reflect on previous years and like how fortunate I've been to be able to experience all these things and have this freedom and go to all these places and hang out with friends, meet new friends, new cultures, all of that. So that's something, I miss the most, I would say.
Yeah, your next plane ride won't feel as tiring. You'd be more excited for it. All right, well, in this show, we go back to the beginning because we want to get into your poker origin story. But before you found poker, what were you getting into over in Stockholm?
Before I found poker, I was training to be a chef. And I did train to be a chef. I graduated culinary high school in Stockholm and then worked for, first I did military service as a cook in the Royal Swedish Navy.
You're jumping too fast here. First of all, what is a culinary high school? That's, you just cook all day, or there's no math classes?
No, it's a mix between the two. So it's a mix between a regular high school where you you have like the standard classes, like the basics basically, which gives you a solid ground foundation in case you don't want to work as a cook anymore, you know, or you want to continue your education and study to become something else. But it also, so it was a mixture of that mixed with like culinary classes, like how to cook and also like working in like the hotel industry and you know, the first year it was kind of broad. You had to do all of these things. You had to wait tables as well, just to like learn all facets of the industry. And then you could, by the second year, you could specialize in one of them. And I specialized in cooking because that's what I found the most enjoyable.
It seems like a young age to pick a career path. What inspired you to want to become a chef?
It was a very young age to pick a career path. I agree, but that's just kind of how the system, at least in Sweden, is built. So by 15, you're supposed to know like basically what you want to do for the rest of your life, or like what path you want to take. And like by 15, you have no idea, you know, what you want to do or even like what you enjoy doing. Like it's not even that easy to figure out at that age. So it's really like a hit or miss. But for me, I was just so fed up with school at that point. So it was actually my mom who suggested, or she asked if there was any other options than, you know, the classic like academic high schools. And the counselor, or whatever you call it, the guide, she's like, oh yeah, there's this like culinary school, like where you combine, you know, doing something practical, but also, you know, gives you this foundation in case you want to switch careers like further down the line. But that just seemed like a great option for me personally, because I was so fed up sitting behind a school bench for 8 hours every day. And I've always enjoyed doing more like practical learning and just like being outdoors and like moving, like sports, and like that's more appealing to me. So cooking really gave me a nice outlet to doing all that things. So yeah, it was just a great match, at least at that time.
It's interesting that you was for practical reasons, like, oh, because, you know, everyone needs to eat or whatever. But, you know, I just assume maybe, you know, you were like a child prodigy in the kitchen and whipping up souffles at age 6 or something. And your mother was like, no, this is you're destined to become the next, you know, whoever.
I did cook a little bit like growing up. I like to bake a lot, which is interesting because now I it's my least favorite form of cooking, because you're so restricted to following recipes. But I guess at that age, I really didn't know how to cook. So the only way to do something that wasn't disaster, yeah, was to follow a recipe, because that was rather easy. And then, you know, the result was better than when you improvise. But nowadays, I just love improvising and just make up my own stuff and like explore with different flavors and different ingredients, and like that's what I like about cooking.
Now tell me about your year in the Royal Swedish Navy.
That was a long year. So it's kind of similar there with the career path. So the process, they come to your school when you're like 14, I think, like very young. And then they show you this video of
well, not too young. You're 1 year away from choosing your career for the rest of your life. So
yeah, but like 6 years before it's time to do the damn thing. So you're basically a kid, and they show you this promotional video of, yeah, you know, you've seen them on TV. It's like, it looks really cool. They're like shooting
guns. Be all you can be, patriotism.
The world, there's, you know, explosions and stuff. It's like, it's really exciting, especially for a 14-year-old boy. So at that point, you decide, oh, yeah, I'll sign up for that. That looks cool. But you don't really realize the implications of it, or like what it actually means. And then years go by, and when I was 20 and I got the letter in the mail, and like, okay, now it's time to serve for 11 months in like a different city. It's like 5 hours south of Stockholm. So I had to take a bus every week back and forth. So every weekend I would go home. Sure, I could stay there, but pretty happy to go home in between for 2 days. So it was a bit of a grind, but at the same time I'm happy I did it. Like in hindsight, because I think it's really good to do, because it like teaches you a lot of things, teaches you discipline, and humbles you a little bit, and you get to meet people that aren't like from all over the country, so like not just the people from your city or whatever. So yeah, I'm happy I did it in hindsight, but I remember at the time I was pretty fed up with it, to be honest. That was because I graduated a year prior, and I just started working at this new restaurant, and I was really enjoying just working as a chef and like working my learning new things and making friends with my colleagues, and like we had a really, really good time. So the last thing I felt like doing was to take a few steps back and then do something else. I was still cooking, but completely different environment.
Yeah. So did they utilize your skills well in the Navy?
Yeah, I would say they did. That was the good part about doing it in the Navy. So if you're doing it, if you're a cook in the Army, it's a complete different story. Cause you're very limited to your budget and like the things you can do. But in the Navy, like we basically got so it was just me and one other guy, and we were in charge of feeding like an entire Corvette of like 40 people. So it was a pretty small crew, but we got a like insane budget. I can't remember how much, but I think it was like $20 per person per day or something, which might not sound like much, but if you add it up, like you can...
Oh, everyone's eating steak tonight.
we could literally order anything we wanted. So we were just like experimenting, you know, like ordering all sorts of things and then doing like tasting menus like once a week, and it was a lot of fun in that sense. And I also learned a lot because since there was only two of us, we're basically like our own head chefs. So like we didn't really have, sure, we had one person like ahead of us that was like supervising us or whatever, but he was barely there. So it was literally like our responsibility to make sure that the menu was set, the food was on the table at the set time, planning the menus, like planning everything. So in that sense, it was a lot of fun.
I got to imagine cooking for 40 people is a little different than cooking for yourself and a partner.
Yeah, it's a lot more responsibility. A lot more planning goes into it for sure.
Let me see here. Do you have a favorite TV celebrity chef?
I would have to say Gordon.
What was that? You have to say Gordon, or you would not say Gordon?
No, I would have to, yeah. No, for sure. I can't think of anyone else, right? I mean, he's such a legend. I used to watch, like, when I was younger, I used to watch this... it was like one of his early TV shows. I can't remember which one it was, when he like would go to restaurants and make like surprise visits.
Kitchen Nightmares?
Yeah.
Maybe. Is it the one where he tried to rescue them?
Yeah.
Let me see. I don't want to get it wrong.
I think that was it. It wasn't Hell's Kitchen where the most of it was staged. This was like very real, like complete disaster. And watching it from like a chef's perspective was really funny because you could relate to so many things.
It was Kitchen Nightmares. Mm. Before he started yelling at contestants. All right, so you cooked on a battleship. That ends, and then what do you do next? You were supposed to go to Spain?
Yeah, so after that, I kind of went back to where I was 11 months prior. I continued working at the restaurant. And during all this time, I was playing poker, like, as a hobby. Especially like during my months in the military.
Well, let's take it back to the beginning of poker. When did you first discover the game?
I first discovered the game when I was 17, so about a year before legal age.
And okay, so that you're looking about the year after Moneymaker?
Yeah. Yeah, around 2004, I would say. I was still in school, I remember that. I discovered it because, obviously once Chris won, like, poker was everywhere, and it was always on TV and, all over the magazines and stuff, so it was hard to avoid it, really. And I've always been sort of fascinated by gambling, and especially like skillful gambling. So it's just a perfect match, I guess. And I just got sucked into it. The fact that it was combined those two elements really fascinated me and made me intrigued to learn more. And then when I turned 18, I got a poker book from my dad, like a strategy book, basically. It was a Swedish book. And it started explaining the concepts and, pot odds and all the basics, basically. But like also a little bit more advanced strategies that I'd never heard of before. Bought a poker set when my friends started playing on the weekends. I realized that I was winning a little bit more than anyone else, and also that I had a lot more passion and patience for the game than they did. And I realized that was like two key elements of being successful as well. And that sort of fueled my desire to continue studying the game and getting better at it and like sort of seeing how far I could take it. And then eventually I started playing online, started playing free-rolls, and then deposited, like, the classic $50 here and there, lost it in the beginning, and then eventually managed to run it up. And then I discovered Sit and Goes, single table tournaments. And I really enjoyed Sit and Goes because it was the tournament aspect, but they were short, so you didn't have to dedicate that much time. But it also involved so many aspects of tournament poker, because you start in nine-handed, there's a payout structure of top three, right. You're playing, you get to practice playing, nine-handed, eight-handed, seven-handed, six-handed, four-handed, playing the bubble, playing heads up. So I really enjoyed Sit and Goes.
Well, I heard in another interview that you were playing Sit and Goes because you didn't have the time to play a full tournament because you were going to get kicked out of an internet cafe.
Yeah, exactly. So that was during my year in the military, where this was internet cafes were a thing, and before I had my first laptop, so that was really the only way I was able to play while I was down there. And Yeah, so playing a multi-table tournament when you're on a time limit is obviously not very convenient, but sitting goes, you can at least predict like roughly how long they'll take. So I had a good idea, but there was a few instances where I was playing and all of a sudden I was, you know, registered a tournament or whatever, and then it kicked off and he hadn't finished yet, and the guy went to go home, so I had to like bribe him to stay open so I could finish it, but yeah, it was fine.
That's how you know you're a good player, because you're not only paying the rake on the sit and go, but you're paying the rake to the internet cafe.
Yeah,
and still turning a profit.
Yeah, but this was, you remember, this was the golden years in poker. Like, it was hard not to make money at that time.
Well, hopefully you made enough to buy yourself a laptop and then take the game more seriously.
I did, actually, yeah. So, like, midway through the military, I bought myself a laptop so I could play on the boat. The only issue was that it was a Corvette, like a pretty modern design. It was a stealth battleship, which means that it couldn't get picked up on the radar. So the only way, it didn't have any windows, so the only way to play was to get up on deck, basically. So I had to sit up there to get reception, because there was no phone reception or anything inside.
That's how you know you really wanted to play. You can get all, getting all these obstacles thrown in your way, and you're like, no, I'll still find a way to get another sit and go in. Oh man. Okay, so what happened? You're supposed to go to Spain, but then
I'm working at a restaurant in Stockholm, and I'm playing poker on the side. So I continue to play poker on my time off, and especially at night after I finish like a shift at the restaurant. I like to play a few hours of poker once I got back, which was usually quite late. I used to get home around 1 or 2 a.m. and then I would play for like 2-3 hours maybe, and then sleep all day and then wake up and do the same thing. But I liked, you know, having something to look forward to when I got home. That was so different from the environment in the kitchen. And now I look at poker as very stressful, but back then it was very relaxing. Like, it wasn't very stressful at all because, well, for one, I didn't play professionally, so I didn't have to make money at it, even though I was obviously aspiring to do so. But I think it's just the difference when you're doing something as a hobby and you're doing it as a profession. Just, you just have a different approach to it.
So what made you decide to focus on poker full time?
So I was doing this time, I started having some success playing. So I continued playing sit and goes, and then I found that there was a pathway to play sit and goes and get into live tournaments, which is something I really aspired to do, and that was like my biggest dream at the time. I remember being on the boat and during my military service and reading like poker magazines and seeing all the ads for like poker cruises in Vegas and reading all the interviews and stuff, and I really fired me up, and that was like my biggest dream back then, to just play one of these live events. So when I realized that I could find a way to get into these for cheaper by playing sit and go satellites, I started doing so, and I managed to win a package to the WSOP. This was in 2008, and I was only 20 years old at the time, but it was my 21st birthday 3 days before the main, so I was
perfect
just
timing.
Yeah, I was just on the bubble to become legal age to play. But back then, you had the option either to take the money or to go and play. So I wasn't really sure what to do because it was such a big lump sum of money. I think it was 12,000.
Yeah, it's hard to say no to 12,000 guaranteed in your pocket.
Yeah, especially when it's the equivalent of a year's salary at the time. And you have no other like real outlets to make money. But yeah, it was a tough one. But I asked my mom and she said, yeah, of course you're going to go play. And when she said that, then it kind of made the decision a little bit easier because I knew in my gut that obviously, you know, I won this and like not that much to lose. Like if I lose this, so what? Like it's nothing's really changed. And if I go, and like who knows what will happen.
And of course, as everyone knows, you went and you became the youngest main event champion in history, right?
That was definitely on my mind, yeah.
You would have been.
Yeah.
But what actually happened that day?
Yeah, quite the opposite happened. I got eliminated as not only the youngest person to play, probably, but I was also the youngest, well, the first person to get eliminated from the entire tournament. I busted on the third hand of day one, only like 10 minutes into the tournament.
So how does one bust on the third hand? I mean, was this just a cooler situation set over set, or?
It was a little bit of cooler, yeah. It was set over set, but both over both, actually. But yeah, we both flopped sets, and then the middle card paired on the turn. And so I had the worst boat possible, basically. And I definitely overplayed it, and the guy bet really, really big. Like, overbet, but it wasn't even a three-bet pot. But I think back then, it wasn't as deep as it is. Not that it's any excuse, but it wasn't as deep as it is today. I think we started with 20K at, like, 50, 100. And I think he, like, 4X'd it pre or something, and then overbet, and then I check-raised the river, and then he went all in. And I remember I'd read in my book that there's something called being pot committed. So that was just what was going through my head at the time. Because I looked at my, like, 4K behind or whatever, which was still, like, 40 big blinds.
Right.
And I was just thinking to myself, well, like, I invested all this money in this pot. Like, of course, like, I can't really fold. Like, what if he's bluffing? whereas, obviously, today, like, there's 0% chance that he was bluffing and I had any sort of equity in the hand anymore. But, yeah, it was a good learning experience, that's for sure.
And then you had all that extra free time in Las Vegas for your first trip, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and then it was just, I didn't even know what side events were at the time, so I was just partying and, like, enjoying life as a 21-year-old in Vegas.
Checking out Gordon Ramsay's restaurant. let's see here. Okay, so before we get into your progression throughout the game, I mean, did you have a blueprint of someone to follow in Sweden? Because I don't know what the poker scene was like back then in Sweden, but you obviously had guys like, you know, Martin the Knife and Chris Bjorn was making waves over here at the time. Or was it not related to that at all?
No, I used to read about those guys a lot. I knew a lot about them. I almost felt like I knew them, even though I'd never met them. Because they were like superstars, you know, in my eyes. Growing up, because they were like always in the magazines and they would always like be interviewed and like write trip reports about their games in Vegas. So I was definitely looking up to them and their lifestyle, and it was something that I was aspiring to become, to like have that lifestyle, you know. That was a big dream, but then I wasn't realistic being like, okay, well, this is definitely what I'm gonna do. It was just like, how cool is this? Like, these guys seem to be living the life, you know. That'd be awesome to do something like that.
You found success pretty soon after that, you know, fail at the 2008 WSOP. So you weren't down for too long. Third at EPT Budapest, you know, for $250,000. So how does that change your life?
It changed my life a lot. So, Budapest was my third live tournament. Between that, between Vegas and Budapest, I went to EPT London, also qualified online, same process as the WSOP. Did a little bit better there, but still busted day one, like out of the money, but still got some experience. And then did the exact same thing for EPT Budapest. Qualified, I think I won a last chance satellite or something. It was a multi-table satellite, I remember. It was like 40 people or something and only one package, and I somehow managed to win it. Sure. And did the same thing, went to Budapest, didn't know anyone, and met a lot of new friends, and the tournament went really well. Managed to get to the chip lead day two, and all of a sudden, you know, I have all these ships, and like, I was like, what the hell is going on? This is my right. third live tournament. So I really didn't know exactly what I was doing. But I was just sort of going with the flow and, like, you know, being confident and just thinking that, you know, whatever happens, happens. And then made the final table and then managed to get third place and make a three-way deal. Like, it was a very surreal experience because everything's happened so fast. Because this was only 3 months after my trip to Vegas, and only 5 months before that, I'd never, like, even been close right. to playing a live tournament. And here I am, not only playing in a big live major in the EPT, I'm, finishing top three for a bunch of money, you know? So that was, like, a huge boost, not only in my bankroll, but also in my confidence. So it was really after that that I was thinking, or even considering, starting to consider that this is maybe something that I can pursue. And if it doesn't work out, I can always go back to cooking. Because I always knew I had that as a backup plan. So that was giving me a lot of comfort, I think, and more willing to take risks.
Any big splurges? I mean, obviously, you have a nice, comfortable bankroll, and you can start playing bigger and more consistently. But did you go crazy at all?
No, I think I've always been quite sensible in terms of that. My biggest splurges are usually just like reinvesting it in poker tournaments, like maybe taking too big of a piece, considering my bankroll. Like I've always done that. I'm not really, I haven't really bought like a bunch of expensive items or spent it on experiences or anything like that.
Before we get to the main event, because you mentioned taking shots, you did have high roller success before the main event win. You finished sixth in the $111,000 buy-in one-drop high roller event for $800,000. How did you get into high rollers, and what was your thought process jumping in with those sharks?
This was in 2013, around there, I think.
Yeah.
And, between here and Budapest, I had a lot of success on the EPT, actually, on the European Poker Tour, where I made a lot of final tables, but I didn't really manage to win one. I think a final table.
Real quick, let's rattle them off for the listeners at home. You finished second at EPT Villamora for $400,000. Converted to American dollars for the listeners. Second at EPT Deauville for $760,000. And then you had a second in Vegas at the Deep Stack. A lot of seconds. Second at WPT Venice. Was it getting frustrating with all the runner-up finishes?
Yeah, it was. I'm not going to lie. It got more and more frustrating for every time it happened. You know, the first time you get third, I was over the moon. Like, I wasn't even upset that I didn't get first. And then the second time it happens, you're like, oh, okay, well, at least I, you know, made a final table and, like, all is well. But then when it happens again, and especially getting second place, can be quite frustrating, because then you're so close on taking down the whole thing. It's just you versus one other opponent. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of swings involved in heads-up poker, and especially during that stage, you know, blinds are pretty shallow, and there's a lot of variance and stuff. So it can be quite frustrating when you don't manage to close it out. And then, not to mention that, like, just I was quite. It wasn't like that. I was hunting the fame or anything like that. I just wanted to know what it felt like to win a live tournament, because I'd never done that, and I'd won tournaments online, and I knew how that felt, and it feels really good, because, you know, no matter what happened, like, you couldn't have done anything better, because, you know, you won. But when you get second, you're always thinking to yourself, like, okay, I could have, you know, probably I messed up this spot or whatnot. But
was there a particularly brutal one that, like, you thought about for a while afterwards?
Yeah, the worst one was in Deville. The it was a really big score. It was a huge field, I think over 1,000 players. And but the worst thing about it was the person I lost to, because obviously that matters as well. Like, if you lose to, yeah, a really good player.
This was Francis Lucien Cohen.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. If you lose to, like, a really good player or like a very nice guy, even if he's an amateur, like, you know, don't mind as much. But when you lose to someone who's not only not a good player, but also, like, very obnoxious and, like, in your face and, like, quite disrespectful, it just makes it so much worse.
Brutal.
Yeah. And that one also was, like, kind of consecutive after I'd gotten second. And third, I think, the same season or something. So it's just too much to handle at the time. I was pretty pissed.
All right. Well, you got revenge in 2014. This was the dream run, obviously. The main event, which you won for $10 million. Let's talk about going into that final table. Because, you know, Mark Newhouse kind of had all the attention. He was going back-to-back. And the rest of the table were new faces, pretty much. But you were short-stacked, so.
Yeah, I was short-stacked. So I feel like, even though I was probably the most accomplished player, or I think by far, with my EPT success, like, most of my success had been on the European Poker Tour, and not in the U.S., and combine that with that I was the short stack. I was the second last in chips. So I feel like I kind of flew under the radar. Like, all the attention was on Jort, the overwhelming chip leader, and Newhouse, obviously, with his accomplishment of making back-to-back final tables. So everyone knew who he was, obviously, because he had been there before. But it was kind of nice, actually, to not be in the spotlight and perhaps be a bit underestimated.
I know you did a ton of studying during that, you know, 3-month delay.
Yeah. So the first thing I did when I made the final table was to start working straight away and, like, thinking, okay, what can I do to prepare? What can I do to put myself in the best position possible to take this down? Because this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and, like, it's not going to happen again. Like, sure, I'm short stacked, but, like, I think I have 37 big blinds, so it's still very deep and great structure, obviously. So I knew I was going to spend these next 3 months just preparing. So I would have zero regrets whatever happened in terms of not being prepared enough and kicking myself in hindsight.
How do you feel, you know, your prep work rated with everyone else? Did you feel like they were doing the same thing, or were there a lot of people just going with what they knew.
It's hard to say. Like, I don't know what everything that went behind the scenes, but just speaking to them when we reunited in Vegas, like days before the final table, doing the media stuff for ESPN, and Newhouse told me that he just spent 3 months in Amsterdam, like partying. And I think Felix was supposed to do a bunch of study work, and then called Scott Seaver like 2 days before the final table, and like, dude, I haven't prepared anything. Like, you got to help me here. So they were like express coaching. So just hearing stories like that, like, and then I think Sindelar just played golf or whatever, but it just gave me like a nice confidence boost, because I knew that was so far away like from what I had been doing. And so everyone's just, or not everyone, but like, it felt like a lot of the guys just treated it as like a sort of like a free-for-all. Like, they're already made it by making the final table, whereas I just saw it as one step, and then the next step was to make sure to win.
Right. I mean, obviously you coming in with the short stack, so I don't know what your expectations were given that, or what you would have been happy with given that. Did you have thoughts about that? Because obviously if you finish ninth, it's a great score, but it's not changing your life. It's just another top score on the list of top scores.
Yeah. No, I think anything but first would have been disappointing to at least some degree. Obviously ninth is the most disappointing because it's the worst you can do at that point. And you've had this time to like think about it and know that the worst you can do is getting ninth.
I had Mark Newhouse on this podcast, and he talked about the depression that followed finishing ninth in this very tournament.
Yeah, I believe it, honestly. I mean, especially back to back, and like coming in, was he 4th or 5th in chips, and talking all that smack before, like, it's, you know, I felt, but honestly, like, aside from all that, like, I felt bad when he busted. Like, that must have been really tough, you know, for him.
But you were just looking to ladder up, or you legitimately would have been disappointed with anything less than a win?
I would have been disappointed if I didn't perform, if I did a mistake, you know, but I knew that, like, I was just having confidence in my preparation, and I was just playing my game and trying to play each spot the best I could, and then whatever happened. That allowed me to play with less pressure, and I wasn't thinking about the money. I wasn't thinking about the importance of winning. I was just like taking everything step by step, and just like trying not be get emotional about everything that was going on the side.
You said a couple years ago in an interview that you hadn't watched the main event coverage. Is that still true?
Yeah, it's still true. I haven't watched the whole thing now. I just the highlights of it.
Any reason?
I mean, it's quite long to begin with, but
it's the highlight of your professional career anyway.
There's really not much going on in the first hours, I realized. There's a lot of folding, but I've watched parts of it, and I'm definitely a bigger favorite to watch the whole thing like soon enough. Whereas in the past, I've kind of, you know, not been that eager to watch it. I don't know why, but I've never really watched my stuff, watch when I play or watch my interviews or anything like that.
Man, I mean, if you're not going to do it during lockdown, I don't know when you're going to do it.
Yeah, that's true. Especially like with the Vegas desire to go back to Vegas and WSOP and all of that. Like, that would have been perfect, actually.
I get it. I don't like listening to myself on this podcast. I was like, that's not what I sound like. You know? The computer changed my voice. It's much deeper in real life. Trust me. All right. So let's talk about your life after the main event win. I mean, you say you don't splurge, but $10 million is a lot of money. Was there nothing that you treated yourself to?
I mean, I bought a nice house that I live in, but no, other than that, not really.
No fancy car, no fancy watches.
I don't have a driver license, so I think that one kind of saved me.
That's true. I mean, you don't really need it in London, do you?
No, that's the thing. I mean, you don't, but like, it would be nice to have. I've just been kind of lazy about it, I guess, and keep justifying it that I wouldn't get a car in London anyway. But when you travel, and especially when you're in America, like, you pretty much need a car everywhere to get around.
Now, where do you keep the bracelet?
Oh, it's in a safe somewhere, but I can't tell you where.
But you don't like have it displayed somewhere.
No.
How often do you pull it out and stare at it?
Not very often. It's not at my house. It's at like a special location.
Okay, you have it at Fort Knox. I get it. It's under armed security. No one even try. Don't even try. And even if you break in, it's a fake. It's a decoy. You know, so no one mess with Martin. All right. What about your motivation to play following the main event win? Because, you know, that's enough money to go away forever, as some main event winners have. Or just start playing higher. What were your thought process following the main event win?
Yeah, I think that the motivation after you win something like that is something, it's a very interesting topic, and from a psychological standpoint, like, I think in what matters is what's your motivation to play poker in the first place. Is it because you aspire to win the WSOP main event? Is it to make money, you know, make a certain amount of money, or just as much money as possible? Is it to, because you love the psychology behind the game and like competing against other players and see how you compare, and like what is it? Do you like the social aspects of it? Do you like the lifestyle? So I think it depends on your answers there, like what your motivation will be like. For me personally, I think I might have underestimated the effect that it actually had on my motivation to continue playing, because you are a little bit in a weird spot. I'm not really sure how to explain it, but winning the WSOP main event for a tournament player, at least, is like, you know, the pinnacle of the game. Like, you can't really achieve anything higher than that. So I think naturally your motivation won't be as high, maybe, and you might want to explore other things that you want to take on and sort of find other ways to compete and challenge yourself. Because for me, like, poker has always been a lot of it, at least, my motivation has come from challenging myself and competing. It hasn't been driven by making money. You know, the money is good because it allows me to play poker and it gives me the freedom to do so. And I can fund my own buy-ins and I can, you know, buy a laptop so I can play online to travel and stuff. But no, it's not. It's not to make the most money possible. So,
well, I mean, like, part of that, you know, ties into what you're doing now, which is, you know, these group coaching courses that I see you putting out there. Because, you know, how often can someone even get a main event champion like that, you know, to be even interested in passing on their knowledge like that? But obviously you love the game enough to want to talk about it at length.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I think it's hard to put it in words, like, how your motivation changes, because there's no there's no clear answer. It's just kind of like how you feel when you play, and like, do you feel differently? I know I did, like, afterwards, but it was also a matter of like, I'd played poker for so long, and I felt that after I won, I was one of the few professionals that won the main event, and I felt sort of a responsibility to embrace the role of an ambassador and sort of continue to like promote the game, not just like in the poker world, but like also outside of poker. And when you do that, it's hard to just leave poker and like don't play anymore and just do that and then do something else. So it felt more natural for me to continue doing what I was doing, which was, you know, I didn't change anything. I was still playing the same tournaments, still going to the same places, hanging out with the same people. But yeah, trying to put poker in like as good of a light as possible and like bringing some maybe new players into the game.
Now, you just finished your relationship with 888, so we don't want to give them too much free publicity. but I was surprised to learn that you didn't get that sponsorship until 2018. So what was the delay there? Why wouldn't a site want to snatch up a main event champion like you?
I don't know why it came about so late. But I was never hunting for a sponsor. Until that point, I'd never been sponsored like my whole career. I think it's just like one of those things that I entered the scene quite late, I suppose, and then the poker landscape looked a lot different at that time than it did previously, where poker benefited a lot more from exposure of sponsoring players, and I think especially in Sweden, they got a lot of resistance from the government, where you're not allowed to promote poker and whatnot. Like, it's all government-based regulations over there. So I think that might have been a big reason why it didn't come about sooner.
And you had already moved to London before your main event win, right? Just access of games, I guess.
I've been in London since 2011, so 10 years now. So I've been in London 3 years before the main event.
I just assume because, you know, easier to find action, more centrally located to...
I don't normally play live poker in London at all. I moved mainly because of for tax reasons, because at the time it wasn't sustainable for me to stay in Sweden, because I knew I wanted to play poker outside of Europe, and any poker winnings that you win outside of Europe, at least this was the regulation at the time, you have to pay 30% taxes and you're not allowed to deduct any losses.
So brutal.
So I did that a few summers. Like, I played the WSOP like I think one or two summers where I made final tables, and I ended up like losing money over the course of the summer, even though I was up money because I had to pay taxes. So it's just, well, this isn't sustainable. And there was like a similar rule online where you could only play within Europe. So you're very, very restricted over there. And then I realized that, if you move to these other EU countries that has a different tax law, you can get around it, and it would allow me to play a full summer in Vegas and go to the US and Australia and PCA, like all of these places that I was dying to go to play, but it just didn't make financial sense if I was staying in Sweden.
Yeah, that's worse than the internet cafe fees for sure.
Yeah, those really ate into the bankroll.
All right, we have some rapid fire questions to wrap things up if you're ready.
Sure.
Let's see here. Okay, so other poker players have ventured into restaurants. I can think of several here in Las Vegas owned by poker players. You know, Todd Brunson's got a place, Cindy Violette, I know. Even other main event winners, Jerry Yang opened a restaurant. Why haven't you done so?
Opening a restaurant used to be a big dream of mine, like growing up, obviously, in culinary school even. But I think the more experience I got from the restaurant industry, the less appealing it was to me. Because I realized I met all these restaurant owners because you were working so close to everyone. And I just saw that they were stressed out of their minds. Like they were so stressed and looked so miserable, all of them. And there was so much going on. There was issues all the time that it just like, I think I'm good, actually. I'm just going to, you know, work in a restaurant, maybe, maybe buy some shares. But like, I don't want to own my own because it's just too much stress.
Now, if you were to open a restaurant, what kind of restaurant would it be? And what would it be called?
Well, it would either be like a healthy fast food type of place, which is like the type of food that I like to eat myself, which is, you know, both taste good, but also have a good like nutrition value. So it's actually good for you and you like sort of eat for performance. Otherwise it would be like a small like fine dining type of place where I can like experiment and like do my tasting menus and you know, cook food from all over the world and like different regions, and those two I think I would really enjoy.
And as far as your name, I know you've given it some thought. I mean,
I have,
dreaming,
yeah.
Chef had to have, right?
Yeah, maybe the healthy one would be called, like, I don't know, Superfood or something like that. And the fine dining place. I don't know. I can't think of something now. Depends.
At least you didn't have the ego to put your own name in there.
Yeah.
Or you could always do, like, a poker pun. Right?
Nah, that's so cringe.
serve like poker themed meals.
Oh,
like,
no.
Oh, tonight the ace of spades is
God, if I do that in my 50s, please shoot me.
You just come out and shake everyone's hand while wearing the bracelet. It could work, man. We're, you know, most restaurants fail, but that one's gold.
Yeah, making America.
What's the most underrated food culture?
I would say Venezuelan.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like not Sweden, right?
Sweden.
How do you feel about your own country's cooking? Because everyone jokes about the IKEA meatballs, but obviously it's more to it than that, right?
No, please don't judge it on that. No, I like it. It's something I miss more and more. Like the more years I'm in London, like, or the older I get, I guess, I start missing like the Swedish culture, and like food is a big part of it. Especially like in the summer and like around Christmas. Like in the summer, we eat a lot of fish, like a lot of pickled stuff like herring and that sort of stuff that's hard to get here. You know, a lot of the foods that you can get in both places, but there's certain types there where like you have to go there sort of to have it. And the same applies during Christmas, where there's a lot of dishes that you don't really have in Sweden, and like a lot of the ingredients are even hard to get by here.
What's the biggest pot you've ever won or lost? Your choice.
Biggest pot ever. God, I'm so bad with like memorizing this, but biggest pot ever. Nah, I really don't know. It was probably during the main event, I would imagine, you know, at the end.
Oh, as far as equity, for sure.
Yeah, how about equity, cash game? Also amount of chips, you know, like boy at the final table and you're playing 500k big blind, you know. That's a lot of
right for sure. What about the best swap or piece you've ever had of anybody?
the best swap I had. I had 25% of Mark Radoja when he won the 10K heads up.
Oh, nice.
Or either that one or the 5K shootout. It was one of the two. It was the 5K shootout, actually.
I think Mark's got two or three bracelets, right?
He does, yeah.
Let's see.
But here. I also convinced him to play that tournament, so, you know.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, what was your largest non-poker wager?
What, like sports betting?
Yeah, maybe you get in the pits a little wild, or maybe a prop bet.
I haven't done much prop betting over the years. I did, this is quite embarrassing, but like during the Chinese poker craze, I did lose, I think about 60,000, playing Chinese poker in like a hotel lobby in WPT Slovakia. And I think it was like 2013 or 2012 or something like that. And that was a lot of money back then. Like it really escalated quickly, and it taught me a valuable lesson that, like, even though you start off playing small, like $100 a point, like if you insert a bunch of bonuses and stuff, and you start doubling down and doubling the stakes, that things can escalate really, really quickly.
In the lobby of the hotel.
Yeah, two good friends of mine. It was me and another friend. We were teaming up, and we were playing two other friends. Like, we'd been out partying that night, and then we got back, and we were just like, oh, let's play Chinese poker. And we did, and we, you know, one thing led to another. And then at the end, we were down. We were stuck like 120,000 euros or something absurd.
Jesus.
Yeah, which was like a big part of my bankroll at the time. So, like, we were... Yeah, neither of us got much sleep that night, and we were like trying to figure out how like we were gonna pay them to begin with, and like thinking of ways. And but then a few weeks later, I got fourth in EPT Berlin, and I could pay him straight away with cash. It's just weird times, man.
Headphones on at the table? Yes or no?
Depends what stage of the tournament and the significance of the tournament, I guess.
And what are you listening to when they're on?
I usually listen to podcasts, but I don't know how much I like that, because it's quite distracting, or can be. So if anything, I prefer just listening to music.
Do you have a celebrity doppelganger? Or have people told you you look like somebody growing up or now?
Yeah, I get quite, you know, but it's always a different person. So there's no real connection, or I don't get it repeat that often. And now it's been a while. But for a while, like, a lot of people said that I looked like Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig. Okay. Yeah,
which obviously a pretty nice compliment.
Yeah, James freaking Bond. Take that.
I'll take it.
Okay, I'm looking at the two of you side by side. You had the same hairstyle, definitely, for a while. Yeah, especially this, you know, where I can see it the most is this scene where he's coming out of the water shirtless.
Yeah, good. Actually, posted a funny. I did an Instagram post a few years ago. I remember when people were like posting pictures of them 10 years back, being like, "This is like where I was," and like, "This is," or I can't remember what it was called. It was called like the 10-year challenge or something like that. And I did that with that picture, and then the other picture was like me playing the WSOP main, which like doesn't really look like him at all. And I put him side by side, and I said something like, "Can't believe it's been 10 years."
Oh, that works. That works. Do you like telling people you're a professional poker player? What's the culture like? Well, I guess in London it's different, but in Sweden, would it be looked down upon, or?
No, it's not for that reason. But no, I don't like it. and I like it less and less. So maybe that's a sign that like I'm at the tail end of my career.
Interesting.
But
you
no,
just don't want to tell people that you won the main event, I'm sure.
Yeah, that I definitely don't like. It's not something I do unless they specifically ask about it. But I think the reason I don't like it is because I've done it for so long and like I know what's coming next, the follow-up questions. So they don't even need to ask me the follow-up questions. I can just start telling them straight away how I got into it and what it's like and the biggest. And then they usually ask, okay, what's the biggest tournament you won or whatever, and then it becomes awkward.
They basically do what I'm doing now, but not recording it.
Yeah, exactly.
But that is interesting, being the main event champion who won a $10 million prize, because if it's just a casual, yeah, I play poker for a living, mm-hmm. and they're like, oh yeah, I won like a few thousand once. Well, how about you?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's got to be awkward. I could definitely see that. What are you interested in that most people aren't? No weird hobbies?
Weird hobbies. I mean, my hobbies are pretty much like cooking and training and mixed martial arts.
Okay. Get any matches or is it just sparring?
Another thing people always ask, hey, when are you going to fight someone in the poker world?
Right.
I don't know, maybe, if I'm setting up a YouTube, maybe I have a shot of like fighting some like old fighter or something that has a name. You can fight for like 20 million.
In the poker world, you could fight Kevin Hart if you want to. So.
Okay. he's pretty good at boxing, man. Like I can't believe was there any footage of that fight between him and Antonio?
I did see some footage of it, and it looked like he was exhausted real fast.
Oh,
that
really?
Was the big issue was just punched himself out real fast.
Oh, okay. That's
Antonio
surprising.
Trained enough to wait.
That's really surprising because he's so small as well. So usually when you're that small, like you have more energy than if you're big, obviously, because you don't exert that much energy when you're punching. And he also seems like a pretty fit guy. Like I always see him like working out and stuff. And strange.
Movie muscles, I think, is what is what Antonio said in the podcast.
Sure.
I don't remember if that's true. What
does Antonio have then?
Exactly. All right. Do you have a nemesis, somebody you can't beat, or somebody who has always held over you?
I would have to be that guy who beat me in DeVille, Lewis Cohen.
Lucien Cohen, there you go. You want to see what he's done since? We should look that up.
I'm good. You know what he does for a living?
I assume he's an arms dealer to evil nations. What?
No, better. He's a rat exterminator in Paris.
Oh, he's the bad guy in Ratatouille then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
that's amazing, being that you you the aspiring chef. Him a rat exterminator.
Yeah, exactly. I was the rat. Yeah, in that movie. That's huge. Yeah.
Do you ever made Ratatouille before?
I have. Yeah.
What's your signature dish that you go to when you have to impress somebody or cook for somebody?
Lately, I've been doing ceviche, which I mean, it's not that hard. It's just getting sourcing the right ingredients. But back in the day, I used to make a pretty nice sea bass. That was like my signature dish.
What do you do for the sides?
So I add like some crushed like new potatoes, and then I put in like a nice like so you have like a mold, like a you make a nice circle, and then I blanch some spinach with white wine and put that on top. So it's like two different layers. You got the yellow, the potatoes in the bottom, and then the spinach at top, and then pan fried fish. And then I made a tomato concassé, like a tomato vinaigrette. That's quite like sweet and like sour, and pour that around, and then serve it with a florin of Parmesan.
See, that sounded fancy just because you used the word blanch, and I don't even know what that means.
It's like when you buy something like really quickly, or you can like steam it or boil it as well, like, but just for a few seconds.
Doesn't matter. You use the word, and it's fancy. All right. Let's see. Okay. Do you have a bold prediction for poker's future?
It's so hard to predict the future, man. Like, before the pandemic, I would say that it wasn't looking that good. And then the pandemic happened, and it's like, somehow poker seems to be doing better, especially like the live scene. I think the poker's future online is very different from the future live. I think online it's looking very dark. I don't think there's much future there unless poker is eventually and hopefully soon moving to the blockchain, where it becomes peer-to-peer and like the fees are better and it's more accessible to everyone. I think that's a very, very realistic outcome. But as it is right now with online, I think it's slowly dying. It saw a spike during the pandemic because everyone's locked in at home and right. No one can play live. But now once live poker is back, like numbers are tiny and it's not looking good at all. And I think the sites are just too greedy. They're putting up too many tournaments, and they're becoming very saturated. But live, it seems, you know, Vegas back to 100% capacity and getting great numbers over there. Florida has record-breaking numbers as well in their live tournaments. And the pandemic is still going on. There's still a lot of people that can't travel or can't play, whatever, because they haven't had the vaccine yet. So I think by WSOP, October, November, once most people have been vaccinated and we're able to travel again, I think it could be the biggest WSOP in a while, as far as numbers go. I don't know. They haven't released a schedule yet.
Actually, they just did it this morning.
No way. Really?
I saw the email, and I might as well, since this is going to be out tomorrow, I might as well announce.
You want to spill the beans?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. What do you want to know? Let's see.
Well, everything.
I just got the press release. So a new story will be up by the time you guys are listening to this episode. Okay, the main event will have four starting flights to choose from, November 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th. Final table on Tuesday and Wednesday, 16th and 17th.
But that's by the end then, right? Because it's supposed to wrap up on the 14th, I think, of November.
Right, yeah. So that's the last events. They got a $500, $5 million guaranteed prize pool for the reunion. The 25K heads up, no limit championship. A $1,000 flip and go.
Oh, come on.
All right.
All right, maybe I'll take that back.
Old school freeze-outs return. So
the
no
what?
Longer, they're saying old school freeze-outs are coming back. So no longer is the main event the only pure freeze-out. Beginning October 6th, every popular buy-in level from 500 to 5,000 will offer a true freeze-out. So no re-entry.
Nice.
Deuce to 7, single draw returns. There's going to be some Bounty Hall of Fame event with a $1,979 buy-in in homage to the Poker Hall of Fame, which was started in 1979. Okay. Oh, and this might interest you. A $50,000 PLO event.
I don't play four cards. I only play two.
And also a $50,000, $100,000, and $250,000 buy-in, no limit hold'em event.
Ooh, okay.
So, if you got a $250,000 burning a hole in your pocket, time to sign up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that just came out today. So, it looks like you're going to be making the trip over?
Yeah, definitely, man, if it's possible. I'm still waiting for my second shot, and then we'll see what the...
It's interesting. There's no Euros over here, and at the U.S. Poker Open that's finishing today.
Yeah.
There were a couple players who had to go to South America for a couple weeks first before they could get into the States. But other than that, you know, it's the David Peters show.
As usual.
Okay, we end the podcast. Sorry, we got sidetracked there. We end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator. Doom. What old person things do you do?
God, so many, man.
Yeah, are you feeding pigeons at the park?
Well, no, I mean, for one, I sleep with earplugs and an eye mask. And it was something I started when I was in the military, actually, and I just haven't been able to get rid of it. So there it was like a bunch of noise and stuff, and there was like light in the room and stuff. I think I started using it when I was taking naps, like in the middle of the day. We had a little break because you wake up so damn early that you're just exhausted all the time. So anytime you have a little break, you want to take a nap to recharge. So I started wearing this eye mask, and ever since I haven't been able to get off it because, I don't know, I'm just used to it by now that even if I lose it and it's pitch black, I wake up straight away. And the same with the earplugs. It could be dead silent, I lose an earplug, and I'm panicked, you know, I wake up straight away.
So that's quite crazy. I have the opposite addiction. I fall asleep with the TV on.
That's nice. I mean,
yeah, so that's just one of the many reasons you and I can't be together.
Sure.
Martin, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing the stories.
Thanks, Julio.
That's it. That is the show. Thank you once again to Martin. You can visit Martin's website at martinjacobson.pro or follow him on Twitter at martin_jacobson. From there, you'll find the info you need to contact him if you so wish to get some private coaching. That's right, you can hire one of the top 40 winningest tournament players of all time to teach you how to play poker. Super cool. Also, we're a little early on this, but be on the lookout for a YouTube channel Martin is putting together. If you'd like to follow us, we're at CardPlayerMedia and at poker_stories. And don't forget to subscribe for a new podcast episode every 2 weeks. If you want to go the extra mile and leave a 5-star rating and a nice review, then let us know you did so with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll say thank you with a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.